Let's go through every single package installed with a Linux install image. I'm going through the software included with Slackware, but these are all open source applications and libraries, so whether you're running Slackware like me, or Fedora, Debian, BSD, or even Mac or Windows, you can probably download, install, and try these on your computer. So chances are, you'll be able to learn something from this podcast. Let's get started. Ostentatious though it may be, I'm going to try to get through all the libs in this episode. See if it's possible. The first one is libpcap. It's a library for packet capture. PCAP, packet capture. It's used in something like a TCP dump, where you're getting a signal and you're decoding it, or rather you're reading it, really. And if you've ever used TCP dump, which we will probably in this app, assuming it's already installed on Slackware, we'll definitely use it. And if not, we'll use it some other time. But if you've ever used it, then it's a little bit like hex dump, which we have talked about on this podcast. You just get the raw data. Now you can get the raw data a little bit decoded for you over in the right-hand column, but it's just capturing the data, the data that maybe you had no other logical destination for, but you can capture it because it's there, and so you can read it into a text file. So that's libpcap makes that possible. Libplist is a library to read the Apple binary property list. It's a plist, is what it's called on Apple. If you've ever had to deal with it, you'll probably hate it. I do. It was the bane of my existence for several years when I was administering a big network that happened to have a bunch of Macs on it, and just trying to deal with the plists in an automated way, trying to set applications to certain defaults, you just couldn't do it. The plist format, especially at that time, I don't think there was a way to read that stuff. I mean, it was just magic property list, you know, stuff that you had to do. Like on Mac, you had to go into the GUI application and click the buttons in order to generate the right plist. Sometimes it would work to do that once and then replicate it across all of the other machines, but I remember even that being a little bit touch and go. Libpng, that's the portable network graphics library. PNG, I mean, it's this thing that I want to love, and I just never truly grew to love it. So PNG, you know, I mean, you've seen PNG graphics, but I mean, on the internet, because they're all over the place. You've probably seen them when you take a screenshot. That's usually or often the default format. PNG, I mean, it's better than JPEG, I guess, but it always tends to be a little bit larger than I think it should be, which is kind of strange because, I mean, then use JPEG. But I don't know, I always felt like I was getting a larger file size and not necessarily that much more for the file size. It's silly. But yeah, I tend to use WebP. And I guess PNG is good for pictures that matter. But it's that weird middle ground, right? If the picture doesn't matter, you're using JPEG. And also, if the picture doesn't matter, why have the picture? But let's say you're posting something somewhere, you want to go as small as possible, reasonably possible, so you use JPEG. If you want big and beautiful and everything is preserved, then you use something like TIFF. Well, TIFF is huge. What's the in-between ground? It's PNG. Now, PNG is supposed to offer fancy things like indexed color, grayscale, GIF, like animation functionality, optional alpha channels, all these other sort of thing knobs and dials that you can tweak to get your image exactly how you want it in terms of that balance between quality and file size. And I guess that's the part of PNG that I don't love. Everything else about PNG is great. but it's the part where I think, okay, I'm going to use PNG, but I just want to I want to do this index color thing to really just leave off the stuff I absolutely don't need. And then, like, it doesn't save you any space, or it does save you a lot of space, but the quality goes way down. Or you just never learn how to use. I mean, an animated PNG is possible. I think I've seen it done, but you got me. I couldn't tell you how to do it. Whereas GIF, you know, that's trivial, almost actually kind of trivial. It should be more trivial. But anyway, PNG, sure, I like it. It's good. It's important. Do I use it? Yes, I do. Would I, do I tend to use WebP instead? Well, yes, but you can say that for any image format lately. Libproxy is next. This is a, I mean, it's about network proxying. It is a library to answer your query as a programmer of how do you get to, for instance, the internet. So if there's a proxy in place, then libproxy finds that and passes it to your application. So you don't have to worry about discovering proxies and sort of figuring out the route to the internet. You just use libproxy, and it sort of answers for you how you get to the place you want to go. According to LDD, it is linked to an application just called proxy, or rather a command simply called proxy. It has this application has no man page and no dash dash help options, so couldn't tell you exactly what that's for. Libpsl is the public something list, public what is it? Public suffix list. This is a list of all the top, well, not all. This is a list of top-level domains. That's TLDs like, you know, .com, .net, .org, .nz, .local probably. Let's see if that's on there. I imagine it would be. Maybe not though. .local, because it's not, that's not like public. Yeah, okay, so .local is not listed on here. So anyway, this is a big long list of sort of the, well, top level domains that people are using in the real world that I guess your application might want to know about. And the interesting thing about this is managed independently. It's a community effort started by Mozilla, and it's meant as a big master list of top level domains that are valid. So if your application encounters a top level domain, maybe you're asking your user to enter, you know, a domain name for you to configure correctly or something like that, or to I don't know, to register or something. If they just enter in something arbitrary and it's not on this list, you could use libpsl to detect that and to determine that that's not a valid domain name. For instance, if you are helping a user, if your application does something on the internet, on the public internet, and you're asking for a domain name and someone types in example.local, it's not, .local is not on this list. So you would know that that's not a valid domain name for the purpose of your application. Top-level domains have, of course, kind of really blown up lately. I mean, within the past decade, I think I just feel like there are domains for practically everything these days. Like you've got like dot club, dot game, dot biz, dot me. I mean, I remember when dot biz and dot me and dot I think US or something like that, they were kind of like they were the new top level domains. You know, there was .com, .net, .org, .edu, .gov for the longest time. Like those were the domain names that you had to choose from, not domain names, top level domains to choose from. And then suddenly ICANN started adding a couple more, like .biz, .me, .name, .info, and people kind of hesitantly adopted those. I adopted .info pretty heavily because I thought that was pretty descriptive of a lot of the stuff that I do, which is distribute information. And it was also at the time very cheap because they were trying to sort of push that into the public view, like, hey, here, please use these domains. And that was kind of a weird time. And then they decided, well, that worked so tepidly, let's just open up practically every word. And so now you've got things like .business, .education, .events, .financial, .network, .place, .technology. That's from Mike Filiter. Lifetime. .hosting. .hosting is another thing. Yeah, so there's a lot to choose from now. Oh, .dev, remember that? It's a good one. .xyz, I use Mastodon XYZ, so that's familiar to me. .app, .services, .site. Yeah, just a lot. So if you go to the public suffix list, which you can look at on publicsuffix.org/list/public_suffix_list.dat, then you can look at everything that's kind of like registered in this list for whatever good that does you. I mean, it's probably not everything, but it is a lot. It's got a lot on there. So there you go. And I say it's not everything because, like I say, .local, well, .local isn't on there, I think, intentionally. But I mean, there are semi-valid domains that you can use. I should do an episode on this on OpenNIC, OpenNIC, the OpenNIC project. It provides top-level domains that don't exist. I mean, they do exist within OpenNIC, but you have to use the OpenNIC DNS server. So you're basically pointing your network to, I guess you could say, a non-standard domain name server that recognizes additional TLDs that would not appear in the public suffix list. Is that a valid public suffix then? Well, I guess it depends on your perspective. From libpsl's perspective, no. From your perspective, if you're using it, and my perspective, if I find it on grep.geek, then yeah, that's pretty valid. All right, next is libcalculate with a Q in it. It's a multi-purpose desktop calculator. That is, calculate is. This is the library that drives it. You probably know about the BC command. It's the, what does BC stand for? Does anyone even know or care? It is an arbitrary precision calculator language. That's, I don't know what it stands for, BC. I feel like a lot of people are introduced to BC kind of early on. I think it's just one of those applications that people writing about a terminal and the Unix commands. It's just BC. Oh, that's a thing that you get output from that is vaguely familiar. The problem with BC, of course, is that you've got things like, how do you do a calculation in BC? Something like echo 1 + 1. Is this even valid? I forget how to use BC. It's such a horrible application. Pipe to BC. Yeah, that did work. Okay, so echo 1 + 1 pipe BC gives you 2. That's good. What if I do 1 * 1 pipe to BC? I get 1. Okay, cool. So this is working. Still a horrible application, though. I mean, it's just silly. You can launch it and use its little interactive interface, which sort of does work, but it does somewhat unexpected things, I think, meaning that 1 / 2 should give you a 0.5, but BC just gives you the 0 because you didn't ask for the 0.5. Well, point is, there's this alternative. There's a great alternative called Calc. That's QALC. It's installed on Slackware. This is what libcalculate is providing, or is. This is the thing that's using libcalculate on Slackware. So if you just type in QALC and then let's do 1 / 2, it gives us the full expression so that you know that it knows what you're doing. 1 / 2 equals 0.5, just as you would expect. You could also do something like 1 * 2 and it writes it back out for you and gives you the correct answer of 2 and so on. So the calc is really nice, and there's a lot of different options for calc. I can't jump the gun and do a full thing on calc right now because we're in the lib section, but it is pretty nice. It's a cool little application, so try it when you get a chance. And that's the result of calculate. Libraw 1394 is what this is. It's direct access to IEEE 1394. Remember last couple of episodes ago, we were talking about lib IEEE 1284 for the parallel port. Well, this is libraw 1394 for the IEEE 1394 port, otherwise somewhat better known as FireWire. FireWire was a, I guess it wasn't proprietary because Apple, I mean, they didn't own it, but it was definitely popularized by Apple, and the big deal at the time was that it was faster than USB. And it turned out that the USB port, again, at the time, was literally too slow. Like, it didn't have the bandwidth to import. I mean, from my perspective, this is what made the difference for me. It couldn't import video. You couldn't send all the bits from a camera into your computer through USB. It's really weird to think about that, but it's true. It was USB 1 dot something, and it was just really, really slow. This is talking about the space pod looking G4 thing, the little the pod people G4. Look it up. Back then, like that, those USB ports were so slow. I don't even know what they were for, to be honest. I mean, keyboards and printers, pretty much, I guess. But IEEE 1394 or FireWire was Apple's workaround for that. And so they would include a FireWire port on their computers. You could plug that in to your, plug your camera into your computer through FireWire, and get video off of the camera. There were probably lots of other really good uses for it, but for what I was doing at the time, that was the main thing for me. Let's talk about LibRevenge. LibRevenge stands for reversed engineering, so revenge, reverse engineering. And this is a library to decode stuff that people didn't necessarily provide the answer on how to decode. So you had things like text documents like RTF or something like that, vector graphics, spreadsheets like Excel spreadsheets, presentations like PowerPoint presentations, and so on. All of these formats that for a very long time, the companies that were making them just decided, not going to tell you how to read those outside of our application. That, believe it or not, was a tactic of companies back before, like the 20, I don't know, the 2015s, 2017, 2018. Pretty recent from my point of view at the time of recording. And I mean, I'm sure it still happens. I mean, you can look at lots of companies that don't publish, like the 3D companies, Eldraw, no, Zedraw. Eldraw is the Lego. Zedraw is the 3D one. They don't publish necessarily all the formats that they save into. And so people have to figure out how to read that data and how to convert it into something possibly more useful. So pretty annoying, pretty stupid. It's one of those things where, I mean, I used to bang on about this a lot more, I feel, but I mean, open standards is really, really important. Like, if you're inputting data into a computer, then you, I think, as the user, have the right to know how that data is being stored. And I can't believe that's sort of a thing that we have to fight for. That is something that should absolutely always happen. You should never lose access to something you have input into a computer. It just seems so obvious, and yet it's something that we have to continue to be vigilant about because companies will try to argue that point. They will try to get away from making that happen. Because to a lot of companies, the privilege of reading your data that you've input into their application is something that you have to continue to earn. Which, I mean, again, it's just atrocious to me to even say it out loud, but that is a practice of some companies, reprehensible though it may be. LibRevenge, I think, is aptly named in that sense because, frankly, reverse engineering shouldn't ever really even be necessary, unless it's in the sense of, yeah, I looked at the source code. That's not really reverse engineering, though. But all of this information that we put into computers, it should be common, not, it should be public knowledge. It should be something that people can understand and analyze and audit for themselves, because it's our data that we're putting stuff into a computer. If no one uses the computer, that computer doesn't do anything on its own. And so there's an inherent sort of copyright to what you do on a computer. I mean, I'm willing to make some concessions, like video game data, like when you input controls, when you're playing a video game. In other words, technically you're interacting with a computer, you're inputting data, you're telling a little avatar on the screen when to jump and when to go forward and when to go back and so on. But I mean, I think, you could arguably say, well, once you get to level 5 on your game and someone else has gotten to level 5 on their game, you've both achieved the same thing. Of course, this gets more complex the more RPG-like it is, where you're choosing different unique power-ups for your character, and then suddenly you're on level 5, but you're a spellcaster, and your friend is a tank, and so you've got these two different sort of data sets. But again, given enough players, you start to probably find what could be arguably called duplication. So maybe that's not as important as, the I don't know, the great American novel that you're writing, or the movie that you're making, or the picture that you're drawing, or the photo that you took, whatever. But anyway, point is, when you put data into a computer, you should own that com that you should own you should own that computer. You should own the data, and you should be able to always get to that data in a meaningful way, regardless of whether you've, paid a licensing fee or for the application to decode it for you. LibrSVG, that is an SVG library. It's a library for handling scalable vector graphics. SVG, I've raved about it before, I think. It's an amazing format. It's XML that describes to the computer how to draw lines. And it describes it through mathematical formula. So rather than saying, okay, I want you to go to the fifth pixel to the right and then go down 20 pixels, and I want you to draw a line from 5 to 20, it says, I want you to go to the fifth percentage of pixels and then go down to the 20% of pixels available and draw a line between there. So that way, if the user scales it up, it doesn't matter. Okay, it's no longer at 5 to 20 pixels. Now it's from, now you've got a bigger thing. So it's from like 10 to 40. I don't check my math on that. And then you've got a line that's completely smooth because the pixels between the 5% mark and the 20% mark, or whatever it was, 10% mark, has been calculated in the moment. It's been calculated from the points and from the any kind of Bezier information, and it's not just painting in pixels as mandated. It doesn't say, okay, well, cool, from 5 to 20, cool, I only need 15 pixels, so I'll fill those in. Well, no, not today. 5% to 20% today is like 140 pixels, so fill that in. And so that's what it does. So to decode all of that information, of course, librsvg is the thing that you would use. LibsampleRate is next. That's something that I'm probably using right now. It is the secret rabbit code. That's what it's called, or otherwise known as just libsampleRate. Thankfully, they didn't call it like libsecretrabbitcode. This is a library to convert sample rates, and sample rates are it's literally how frequently, how many samples of an audio signal a computer takes while recreating that audio signal into a digital file. So CDs are famously 44.1 kilohertz. Well, I say famously, I don't know why I said it famously, but I mean, they are 44.1. That's a CD sample rate. And I guess it was famous because it just sounded so good to everyone, like that. At that point, you had enough samples. That's 44,100 kilohertz. you had enough samples per second to recreate this sound really, really crisply, without degradation. You go down to like 33 kilohertz, and you do start to you start to notice it. 48,000 kilohertz got used by digital audio tape recorders, DAT recorders, and by DVDs. And today you can go all the way up to 96 kilohertz, but I don't feel like anyone does. I feel like a lot of people have just decided, myself included, that 48 kilohertz is enough. Like that's the resolution of sound to the human ear, I guess. Applications like FFmpeg and Audacity and Sox, they'll be using libsample rate, if I know my compile flags correctly, or my compile options correctly. Libsass, SASS. This is a library to implement what they call SASS in C and C++. SASS is, I'm not sure, popular among web designers who really need a little bit more out of CSS than what CSS delivers itself. I feel two ways about SASS. I feel like on the one hand, it is more complex than CSS. You get to, you can create like functions essentially in SASS, thereby utilizing CSS, snippets in different for different objects almost, as it were. And that seems useful because then you don't have to go through a bunch of different places in your CSS and change, oh, I actually wanted this to be that line, that width or that size or whatever. You just you declare it once, and then within SASS you can just adjust it, in that one place, and it ripples through all of the places that it gets used. There's more to it than that, but that's an example. That's the kind of thing that SASS would provide. So SASS is more complex, and that kind of not frightens me personally. It sometimes annoys me personally, but it's one of those things where it's like, I don't know if it needs to be that complex for everyone. So I guess SASS is nice for the people who need CSS to be boosted. I'm just really glad that it is indeed its own thing and that it's not CSS. Because I think if it was CSS, I think then CSS would stop being quite as accessible as it is now. And frankly, CSS isn't all that accessible now. A lot of it confuses people who just don't look at the internet as a thing that's generated by code, or rather they do look at it that way and that scares them. So CSS isn't necessarily amazingly accessible. I mean, a lot of people just avoid it. They just can't be bothered. They learned HTML back in 1995, and that's enough for them forever, for the rest of their lives. Libsass goes beyond, you know, 2000 era internet. It's like the future. So, and I don't think it's not everybody's future. It is definitely for people who need it. This is a library to decode all of the special markup that libsass uses, the special syntax that it uses. Let's talk about libseccomp. This is the enhanced seccomp library. What does that mean? Well, it's a big topic, and the nuances I'm not familiar enough with to even discuss, but I can say that BPF stands for the Berkeley Packet Filtering System, and it is just kind of what you would expect from that name. I mean, it's a packet filtration system, so an application running on a computer can kind of communicate with the kernel and tell it which packets it actually needs to receive from the kernel. So if you're running, for instance, we were just talking about TCP dump, you could tell, well, TCP dump tells the kernel, hey, I, or, with certain switches, it tells the kernel, hey, I only want packets that have initiated the TCP connection. So don't give me everything coming in, just give me the things that is coming back from a call from this computer and so on. And that's just an example. There's, you can filter by lots of different things, and that's partly, that's what BPF does. Now, there's an extended BPF as well these days, and that extends it from network traffic to other places like Unix sockets and things like that. So extended BPF can look at even more sources than BPF could. What all that's got to do with SecComp, secured computing, I mean, it's the outside world coming into your computer. How do you deal with that? SecComp gives you a language, a filtration language, so that you can talk to the sort of underlying BPF system. And that's really all I know about that topic. I've read several articles on eBPF specifically and the different things they're doing with it in the kernel. And I mean, I just don't have any real world experience with it, so it's hard for me to conceptualize. LibSecret, that's a GObject or GObject based library for accessing the Secret Service API. Is that the real name of the API? I guess it must be Secret Service. So this is a library to communicate with whatever system on, or with whatever subsystem on a given system contains passwords and other sensitive informations. Generally, that's going to be using Dbus so that it can interface with things like K Secret Service and GNOME Keyring. I feel like there are a couple of different secret storage systems on Linux, and I'm almost tempted to say, oh, it's too many. It's too many to choose from. But actually, I don't think so. I kind of like it. I kind of like the level of choice that you have as a programmer in terms of what you want to actually interface with. I think the secret stuff is really tricky. I mean, surprise, surprise, right? Like, encryption and keeping people secure on their computers is tricky. Who knew? But I mean, I'm just kind of thinking of it from a how kind to your user standpoint are you? So, I mean, it's obviously important to keep this stuff secret, but how do you make the user aware of where their secrets actually are? How they can preserve them as a backup, how they can remove them, how they can interface with it not through your application, and so on. I think one of my favorite systems for that is GPG, and maybe that's just because it's the one that I'm most familiar with, but I mean, I could extend it to, for instance, Password Store, which is the password storage system I use. It's the Unix pass command, or the pass command, which I think calls itself like the Unix style password wallet or something like that. I don't know. But if you look at how that stores your data, it's in a hidden folder in your home directory, full of just the names of websites that you have a password for. And I think you can even obfuscate that. I think I could be misremembering. I believe you can. So if you had a password for a site that you didn't want to just have listed in an unencrypted way, I think you can just call it anything. The file can be called anything, and then in the file itself, you specify the URL. I believe that's how it's done. Don't quote me on that, but I think so. Either way, you've just got a list of files with, .gpg at the end, and you can use those for lots of different things. You can use it as a password manager for a web browser, and there's web browser extensions that can load that sort of database. It's not really a database, it's a folder of files into its memory, and that way you have access to your passwords. But you can use it for arbitrary storage or whatever, because it's just GPG, which I really like. You know where you're going to your GNU privacy guard stuff is. You can point to that on your home directory. You can point to the files that you have encrypted as GPG. It all feels very sort of out in the open. The exception there being the keyring. I feel like the keyring is a little bit confusing, but even that, I mean, you can access it. You can dump it out into a an encrypted file. Like it is something that you can kind of reach out and grab hold of if you feel the need to. Let's do one more, then we'll do a coffee break. This one is the libsig C++. It's a callback system, type safe callback system for standard C++. It implements type safe callback system that allows you to define signals and then connect those signals to any callback function. I've talked about this before when I was talking about qutes, signals and slots. Is that what they call it? I think so. Signals and slots. This is actually, this is basically that, but for GTK. Well, GTK MM specifically, MM being that weird C++ suffix that projects seem to use a lot. There's a beautiful little, like, I don't know, 22 line with a bunch of white space, 22 lines of code example on the GitHub repository. Go to libsig C++, spelled out +++, /examples/hello_world.cc. It's a great little example. I'm going to even read it here. Hash include IO stream, hash include string. Easy. Hash include sig C++/sig C++.h. That's the header file, obviously. Void on underscore print parentheses const std colon colon string ampersand str close parentheses open curly brace std colon colon c out redirect into that str semicolon. So that's literally just a function to send to the output, the standard out. That's the C out function. Sends to standard output a string. Well, where is this string defined? Well, it's not defined yet. That's the beauty of object-oriented programming, I guess. And then close curly brace. Int main parentheses parentheses curly brace. Sig C colon colon signal void parentheses const std colon colon string ampersand close parentheses. Oh, I forgot. So signal angle bracket void parentheses const std colon colon string ampersand close parentheses close angle bracket signal underscore print semicolon. Okay, so what we've done there is we have created a new object called signal, or a new call called signal underscore print. That doesn't exist. That's not a function. Remember, we had a void on print. This is signal underscore print. We then invoke signal underscore print dot connect parentheses sig c colon colon ptr underscore fun parentheses ampersand on underscore print parentheses parentheses semicolon. So we've now taken our new function signal underscore print, and we've done a dot connect because this is an instance of sig C++'s signal variety. So we've just created a signal, and now we're connecting that signal to something. What are we connecting it to? Well, to through the sig c colon colon ptr underscore fun a pointer function to on print. That's the function we're connecting it to. And now we can use that as if though it were a call to on print. So you could do signal underscore print dot emit. So now you're sending a signal out into your application space. Parentheses quote hello world close quote close parentheses close semicolon return zero semicolon close curly brace. And so now all you've done is you've emitted this signal out into your application's sort of processing space, and on print hears that signal and gets triggered and does its standard C out to whatever you've just passed it, which in this case, in this example, was the string hello world. How is that different than just calling on print? It kind of depends on the structure of your application. Sometimes, certainly for a simple hello world, that's not all that impressive because, yeah, you could just call on print and just have it print a string. Simple. But you can't necessarily do that if someone clicks a button. You might want to be able to pick up that click, broadcast it through your application, and anything that's connected to that button then gets executed. It's a really handy system. It's one of the things that makes Qt such a nice little application framework to work with. And the fact that that exists for GTKMM is really, really nice. So check that out if you're ever doing GTKMM, I guess. Now it's time for coffee. Let's go get some. We'll come back and try to finish up this episode and the lib section. And I'm back with a cup of coffee. This is still that grid coffee that I got from the random cafe in Dunedin. It is still quite delicious. Sometimes I drink it and I just close my eyes and enjoy the flavor. You know, I mean, isn't it great when you can do that? I don't know if you ever do that, but you know, when you can just relax into a cup of coffee sometimes, that's a great feeling because it's just so flavorful or rich or whatever. It's good. So, this has been a very satisfying bag of coffee. How are we doing here on getting through the entire lib section in this episode? Not great. So we're in the S's, that's near the end of the alphabet, but there's a bunch of T's and U's and V's and W's and X's in this section. A lot more than I guess I thought. And you know, or than it looked. I scroll through it and I think I can do that. But it is deceptive because a lot of these entries have three or four entries, you know, like because there's the TXT, there's the TXZ package itself, and then there's the signature for that package. So you see chunks of things and you just kind of you have to combine it in your mind. So you're scrolling through and you're thinking, oh, that's not that many. Well, no, it's still that many. So I'm not going to get through it in this episode, but that's okay. I mean, I don't want to ever get to the point where I'm just trying to get through a list because then I'm just reading names of packages. You can do that yourself. That's not interesting. At least let's ponder why the packages are there for a moment. So that's what we're doing. Lib sig seg v is the next one. It handles errors in what's called paging, which is when, well, in it's memory. They call memory pages, and I don't actually know why. But sometimes an application might try to access a section of memory that's not available to it for whatever reason. There are lots of different reasons why that might happen. A garbage collector might have come up and cleared that out, thinking that you didn't need it anymore. Who knows? So what happens when that happens? Or what do you do when that happens? Well, you have to decide. Your code has to, you have to code that in to your program because your program computer's not smart enough to figure out what to do when you tell it to go to memory address, whatever, and it tries to go there and it can't get there. Now it's returning. What does it do? Does it return nothing? Does it try again? Does it throw an error at the user? Does it take some other tactic in the code? You have to figure that out, but libsigsegv is the library that can help you figure that out. Next up after that is, I mean, that's all I know about that library. I've never had to do that myself, at least not with libsigsegv. I've had to catch errors before in programs, but never in a C thing with memory addresses. That's way too low level for my interest level. Next up, though, is libsoundfile or libsnd file. So I'm assuming it's pronounced libsoundfile. It writes, well, it reads and writes a bunch of different audio formats. So we're talking WAV, AIFF, AU, RAW, a bunch of others that I've never even heard of, like Commodore Amiga, IFF, SVX. Don't know what that means. I mean, I know Commodore was a computer. Amiga, I guess, was also a computer. I'm assuming because they're in the same box, the same computer. I know nothing about it. IR Cam SF, never heard of it. Creative VOC, never heard of it. SoundForge W64, vaguely remember hearing something about that. GNU Octave, which actually isn't a sound. I mean, GNU Octave is not, even though it's called Octave, it's not just a sound. You know, it happens apparently to produce MAT4 and MAT5, apparently sound files, but that's not exclusively what GNU Octave does. Portable voice format, PVF, never heard of that one. And a bunch of others, including Apple CAF, and of course, free lossless audio codec, which is FLAC. So all of those things. And so again, you're going to find libs sound file linked to things like FFmpeg and socks and maybe something like lame, maybe, probably. I mean, any application that needs to read and write these very common audio formats. So let us now talk. And, you know, actually, backing up, I think there's an argument, and it's not a great argument, but there is an argument that I personally like. It's still not great. I'm not promoting this. I'm not giving this the stamp of my approval. I just happen to actually secretly like it. I think there's an argument that an application really only needs to put out, uncompressed or barely compressed audio. Like, give me an exporter for FLAC, I'm happy. That's all. Don't bother coding any more than that. It's fine. I'm fine with just a FLAC exporter because you know what? I'm going to go encode that, re-encode that myself anyway. Like I say, it's not a good argument. It's actually not very user-friendly. It would be a lot easier for more people if there is, like, also an AUG converter, Opus converter, MPEG-4 converter, whatever. But, yeah, personally, from my perspective, the way I prefer to do things, I'm happy with just an exporter. Libsound file, give me a FLAC. I'll go and make all the different other formats that I want myself. So, I don't know. I would almost not mind it if more programs sort of had that as an option, you know, essentially so that I don't have to link as much necessarily against them. Again, not a great argument, but it is an argument, and it's something that I do not mind. I can't remember the last time I've exported, for instance, an AUG or an Opus or something out of Audacity. I just don't do it. It's just not something I do. I export FLAC, and that is it. Okay, anyway, that was neither here nor there, I guess. Libsodium. This is a cryptographic library. You can probably guess, if you're vaguely familiar with cryptography, probably guess what this provides. Libsodium. Sodium is salt. It is a library to add salt to your hashes. What that means is it's a reliable little library with a bunch of, it's a little library with a bunch of functions that help you reliably encrypt things sort of better than not using libsodium. So there's a peculiarity that someone noticed long ago about encoding something, and that is that if you have a secret word like password 123 and you encode it, then if someone else has the same word like password 123 and you encode it, the results are the same. Now, most people looking at that result wouldn't know what it was. It just looks like an encoded entity. But if you happen to know that encoded entity, because maybe that's your encoded entity, and then you see someone else with the same encoded entity, you think they're using the same input that I'm using. So in other words, and this is a terrible example, but let's just do it anyway, I guess. Let's do echo password. Actually, let's even make it shorter. Echo pass, P-A-S-S, and pipe that through the good old Caesar cipher. So Caesar, C-A-E-S-A-R, space 6. Actually, you know what? Let's do a Caesar cipher of what? 2? There we go. That's even easier to recognize. So we got pass. We've offset it according to the Caesar cipher by M-N-O-P-Q-R, 2 letters. So we just shifted over 2 letters. P becomes R, A becomes A, B, C, S becomes S-T-U, S-U-U. So R-C-U-U is pass through our fake little hash there. And so if anyone had the word pass and they saw R-C-U-U on a server as their secret password, they might think R-C-U-U. That's exactly what I use. That's also what this other person has used. Therefore, their password is the same as my password. But if as the administrator I use, I add salt to the encryption that I'm using, which, by the way, Caesar cipher is not encryption, so don't actually use it for anything. I'm just using it as a really simple example, which you're going to appreciate in a moment, because now I have to generate some random characters. So if we do instead echo space pass backtick T, or are we supposed to use backticks or dollar signs now? I don't know. Dollar sign parentheses TR space dash DC space space capital A dash capital Z lowercase a dash lowercase z 0-9, and then redirect the input of dev u random to that, so left pointing angle bracket slash dev slash u random pipe head dash c, I don't know, 3 parentheses, and then pipe that to Caesar, what was it, 2. Now we have RCUU5DQ, and if I do it again, RCUUPWA. So same password, but there are these extra characters appended at the end, and who knows what they are? Well, that's the salt. That's the thing that makes something that's the same look different. And if we actually do like something other than Caesar, like let's just do like a SHA-1. Is it SHA-1 sum? Yeah, SHA-1 sum. So for one of these, I've got 131 ending in 41F. And then doing that again, I've got A7F ending in FED. So two completely different jumbles of numbers from really the same password, the word PASS, pass. And yet one starts out 131.8300, the other one is A7F120. And again, the endings are completely different. So if you look at those two strings, you have no idea that they start with the same root. And that is because the sum total of the whole thing are they're wholly unique. They've got that salt added in. So the salt is just a unique thing that you add to a known value to make the encryption of it less recognizable. Now you need to keep track of the salt, obviously. So this example that I'm doing, while clever, I don't know what it means, right? Especially the one that I've just done, where I'm just piping everything to SHA-1 sum. So I never see what the salt is. I don't know what that, I'm just randomly generating from devu random 3 letters that I don't know. So in real life, this specific methodology would not work. I would never be able to then decrypt this SHA-1 sum because I don't know what I've appended to it to produce these results. But that's fine. Like you can do that. You can keep track of the salt. All you need to know is what the salt was and how to decrypt the whole string. The point is that the end result itself is not the same as something that started with the same root word. And that's what libsodium does. If you go and look at the libsodium.org website, it's actually got a really nice write-up of all the different things that it does. So if you're curious or if you need to use it or something, go read it. That documentation's really, really good on that site. Libsoup. Well, for whatever reason, there's this thing where soup refers to HTML, HTTP. I don't know who started it. I don't know if libsoup came first or beautiful soup came first. I don't know. But soup is a thing, apparently. Libsoup is an HTTP client server library written in C. It uses G objects and the glib main loop to integrate with GTK plus applications. It's got synchronous API so that you can use it in threaded applications, so you can make a call and then do other stuff while that call is coming back to you. So that's libsoup. LibSpectre. LibSpectre is a ghost script wrapper library. LibSpectre, or rather PostScript, is the language of printers. It figures out how the letters need to be drawn and rasterized for the printer to form them on paper with little dots of ink. That's what PostScript is. The free and open implementation of that is GhostScript. There's a great little ghost, should I call it a get great? There is a GhostScript command. Its syntax is admittedly pretty weird, but I do use GhostScript quite a lot to modify things, to shrink PDFs, that sort of stuff, to replace fonts, all kinds of things. So it's a very useful application to command. LibSpectre wraps that up and makes it into a library so that you don't, you know, I mean, that I think I've mentioned this before. Like, there's a difference between a library and a command. A command is the thing that you as the user type into a computer. Now, there are ways to make the computer type that into the computer. You know, you could do, like, in Python, there's I think it's the shell. I think it's called shell now. Maybe not, but there's like a command where you say, okay, I want to invoke, you know, bring up a shell sort of to Python, and hey, Python, pass these words onto the shell. And you could do like, I don't know, GS, which is the GhostScript command. And that's all I can remember. Dash format equals, or not equals, dash format, comma, ebook, you know, something like that that Python would be able to parse as a dictionary or as a list, I think is what they call it. A list in Python parses it, sends it into the shell function, and that types in the command functionally for you and returns the results to Python, which you can then parse and do whatever you need to do. So there are ways to do that, but it's a lot easier if there's just a library where you just say, you know, specter dot, I don't know, you know, ghost script function and do some ghost script stuff with that, you know, through the library. So you don't have to sit there and pretend like you're using an interactive shell in Python. You just use the library. You make the call. That's what libspecter can do for ghost script. Libssh, multi-platform C library implementing SSH version 2 and version 1 on the client and the server side. Libssh lets you, you know, the whole world of SSH is open to you. You're going to see this sort of thing linked in applications like file managers that communicate over SSH, over are probably rsync. Well, it would have to be rsync, right? Because you can do think r you can use rsync over SSH. So yeah, this is it. This is SSH as a library, and there's a libssh and a libssh2 doing the essentially the, you know, the work of SSH in a library. Let's talk next about libtasn1. That is an asn.1 library. That's the abstract syntax notation 1. ASN.1 is an IDL, which I think we talked about, like, because there was like a lib IDL, or I mean, I know there was IDN, but I'm pretty sure there was IDL as well. Either way, we've talked about this sort of thing before, and it is the so IDL was the interface description language, and it's, if you just take it way back, I mean, it's almost, I just had the name of a similar concept and it flew out of my mind, but it's a way of describing the requirements or the expected form of communication, and that's what ASN.1 is. ASN.1 is handled by a lot of very big, important protocols like LDAP, for instance, but a bunch of stuff for like multimedia and even like mobile stuff like GSM, Global System for Mobile something or another, that uses IDL. Kerberos, you not IDL, ASN1, Kerberos, lots of different things. So ASN1 defines basically the format of information you want to pass from system to system, and it's just obviously really important to come up with this stuff, because that way everyone can kind of, I mean, really, literally, everyone is speaking the same language. Now, if this didn't exist, or if you wrote something and didn't know this exist and therefore violated all of its ideas, or maybe you know it exists, but you're belligerent and you just don't want to talk in ways that other people can understand you, I mean, there could be converters. That there someone would probably write a lib belligerent converter so that when you send all of your information about your system in this wacky backwards way that no one else understands, then they could use lib belligerent to then like sort of reverse engineer or at least, well, you know, transform what you have sent. But ideally, that's, you know, like the less of that we have, the better. And it's things like ASN1 that helps everyone just kind of conform to, like, okay, so, you know, and it can be as simple as, okay, you want the top level domain first, and then the domain name, and then the subdomain. Great. That's the order in which I will send you the information. Or you want the subdomain first, and then the domain, and then the top level TLD, whatever it's called. Okay, great. I'll send it to you in that order. I mean, that's probably pretty simple stuff, but you know, I mean, it can be as simple as that kind of thing. It could also be, well, here's the XML schema you need to use so that everyone can just really quickly look at your XML and extract all the information it needs with the context that we require. So ASN1, very important. LibASN1, I guess, must have something to do with, or what is it? LibTASN1 must have something to do with decoding it, quickly with C. Libtheora, that's the Theora video codec library. I have not used Theora in ages, but Theora is a codec, and it was a fine codec. I used to use it all the time. It's if you want to do essentially AUG, not just for audio, you want your video to be AUG encoded as well. So that's what you're using, Theora. Theora never really took off all that much. I mean, I think, was it ever included in Firefox? I have it in the back of my head that it was, but I could be making that up. I mean, it was a fine codec. Like, there was nothing wrong with libtheora. It's just, it didn't gain a whole lot of sort of popularity. VLC obviously could play it, so you can play libtheora still. Libtheora, the library, is still maintained. It's here. You can play it. You can play Theora in lots of different media players on Linux. So it's a valid thing to use. It's just not as widespread as, well, certainly these days, WebM, which, I mean, you may as well just use WebM. The quality's great. The file size is small. It's an open codec. Why not? LibTIFF. LibTIFF is the tag image file format. I never knew that. TIFF. TIFF is kind of super important. It's an uncompressed file format for image data. They're big files, but when it's really, really important that you're getting full, all the data, then TIFF is one of the formats you might think about using. You might also just use OpenEXR, which I haven't used TIFF in ages. I think maybe probably because OpenEXR exists. OpenEXR, I think, has been developed, I want to say, by Industrial Light and Magic, but it could have been Sony. More likely it's both. I think Weta had a little bit of code in there as well. A bunch of the different sort of big effect houses have kind of gone in on OpenEXR. And the advantage of OpenEXR is that it's very, very flexible. You've got lots of different kinds of information you can add into your file. Stereoscopic, I believe, was one of the big ones. But also, like, the color space and just lots of sort of extra data that you need to have preserved. That's an interestingly big sort of consideration. I don't want to say it's a problem necessarily, although it is, but I mean, it's a consideration. If you're working, collaborating with a bunch of other system applications or people using applications, you do need to make sure that all the data that you put into something gets transferred over. And that can be something just as sort of simple as, let's say one person is doing work in Photoshop for some reason, and let's say they assign a color label to one of their layers, so that when you look at the photograph or the graphic, you look at the layers that are present, there's one that's marked red. Like, in the label of that, the name of the layer is red. It's trivial, but people do it all the time. And they use it, because we're human and we like differences, they use it to highlight something. And so if you get a Photoshop file sent to you and they say, I just need your opinion on the red layer, or I just need you to fix the red layer, or do all your work on the red layer, whatever. Okay, great. Open up in GIMP or Krita. Is that red label retained? Well, actually it is, at least in GIMP. I haven't tried it in Krita recently, but in GIMP it comes up labeled. So you would be able to latch on to that. You could say, okay, that's the red label that they're talking about, or the red layer. Maybe there's a couple of red layers that they've marked. So it's kind of like if you had a PDF and you highlighted a word or a quote that you really like. And so you send that PDF to a friend, because it's a Creative Commons licensed PDF. You send it to a friend and you say, look at that highlighted quote I did. They go to look at the highlighted quote and there's no highlight, because their PDF reader, for some reason, doesn't render highlights or something like that. I don't know. I don't know if that ever happens. I don't highlight PDFs and then send it to people. I think I've highlighted a PDF before, but I can't think of whether it's something that I don't do it often. So anyway, is all that data, and it can be more major than that. I'm kind of using almost metadata as an example, but it can be something very, very important. Like, here's a 3D model. Here's their skin. I'm going to send this 3D model to the lighting department. Does the skin go with the model, or does the skin just get dropped by the lighting software? That's really important. And
I have horror stories from some of the work that I've done where the skin gets dropped, and so you get the 3D model, and it's just skeleton and muscles. It's horrifying. Anyway, you need to make sure that all that stuff is kind of retained. And not libtiff, OpenEXR. Why am I talking about this? Oh my gosh, this is why we're only in the T section of lib. Anyway, OpenEXR enables you to do that. You can really glom on a lot of stuff onto your image, whereas libtiff, it's pretty much just the image. It's like, here's the image, here's a, no compression, here's a little compression, whatever, that's it. So OpenEXR, a lot more flexible. Sorry, that was a completely side, like a tangent, not at all related actually to what we're talking about. Okay, next up is libunistring. It is GNU Unicode String Library. I mean, what can I say? It provides Unicode strings for C. That's easy. Unicode instead of ASCII. And I think that's it for this episode. But I mean, we got through the T's and the S's where we started, and the P's. MNOPQRST. So I mean, that was theoretically five letters, although I don't think there were any Q's, and strangely, I don't think there were any R's. Oh, there was an R. Revenge. RSVG. Okay. So all we have now in the lib section is the U, V, W, and X, which, I mean, believe it or not, oh, and Y, because there's a libyam, oh, and Z, libzip. Okay, so there's still quite a lot left, and of course, I remind you that once we're done the lib section, we're not actually out of the L directory. We're just past the LI section. So after libs, there's going to be like LMDB and loudmouth and LZ4 and all the way down to, Z. So there's still quite a lot to go in the library folder, but we are almost out, possibly one episode out, of the lib section. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you next time.